Hi, everybody. Welcome back to It's Not Magic, our podcast from Sixth Street. We invite influential and thoughtful people, leaders and founders, to get to the core of how they're doing interesting and intentional things to stand out in their industries. Today is super important and was even a little fun. I spoke with two longtime political operatives who have run dozens and dozens of statewide and national campaigns for Republicans and Democrats. We had a spirited conversation in front of CEOs and other business leaders at our annual Sixth Street MASH CXO Summit in Arizona in April. The audience were leaders from across our growth equity portfolio, and this session was one of many giving these folks and our team insight into current political, geopolitical, and macro trends affecting their markets and companies.
Welcome to your, you know, political therapy session, right? When reporters call me and ask me questions about polling, I said, I'll give you my, you know, thoughts on where the polls are, what they mean, but you really should call a psychologist. And I don't mean that as like joking. I mean, we're in a very strange time in America. We have this political divide that is real and it's intense.
Yep. It's also like the party infrastructure on the ground game, folks yep. turning out, knocking on doors, yep. turning folks out. That really matters. If you have a good governor's race or a good Senate race down ticket, that will help to drive a lot of that for the presidential.
That's John Anzalone and Phil Cox. John is President Biden's pollster. He's the founder of Impact Research and one of the nation's top Democratic pollsters and messaging strategists. Phil is a longtime Republican political operative and a trusted advisor to Governor Chris Christie, among others. And he's the founder of GP3 Partners, one of the nation's largest corporate communications and public affairs firms. You'll hear Phil and John help separate signal from noise in the upcoming presidential and down ballot elections here in the U.S. and help companies and us figure out what we should be watching for as the year unfolds. This conversation was incredibly valuable for our team and our portfolio company partners, and I'm sure it will be for you as well.
Morning. Hi. Morning. Nice to see everybody.
Good to see you.
This is exciting. That's the first order of business. Let's introduce properly our esteemed guests. So, John Anzalone, as Christie said, a big deal in Democratic politics nationally and in various other ways. You're the founder of Impact Research. That's a full-service public opinion research and consulting firm, one of the nation's top pollsters and messaging strategists. You've spent decades winning some of the toughest political races in recent history, which I think means winning races no one expected you to win, which is probably a good definition of it. You've polled for the past four presidential elections for President Obama, Hillary Clinton, and President Biden. You've helped elect U.S. senators, governors, dozens of members of Congress, more than 30 years of experience in message development and strategic execution. You've been called on by key decision makers, executives, CEOs, corporations, nonprofits, trade associations, everybody, to navigate complex challenges and achieve their goals in a changing world and marketplace. That's kind of what we're doing here today, so that's kind of good. You're from St. Joseph, Michigan, the pride of St. Joe.
Yeah.
And you've lived for a long time in Montgomery, Alabama.
Yes, that's a long story.
Which I want to talk about.
Yeah, Roll Tide.
Roll Tide.
We got a big game coming up, you know, right here.
So. Democratic pollster Crimson Tide, kind of interesting. Okay, we'll talk about that. Phil Cox, founder of GP3 Partners, one of the nation's largest corporate communications and public affairs firms. Nearly three decades in politics, Phil's helped to elect more than 30 Republican governors, directed presidential super PACs, served as a senior advisor to numerous campaigns for the U.S. House and Senate. From 2011 to 2014, you led the Republican Governors Association. 2019, you served as the national co-chair for TradeWorks America. That successfully advocated for the passage of the USMCA that was the replacement to NAFTA. You serve on the board of the Senate Leadership Fund, the principal super PAC focused on electing a Republican Senate majority, which looks kind of likely in 24, we'll talk about that. And Win Red, the GOP's principal small dollar fundraising operation. You were a senior strategist for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in his 2022 reelection and then in his presidential bid. You're a trusted advisor to former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, and lots of other governors and senior Republicans around the country. The Boston Globe called you a force for the GOP. The Washington Times called you a Republican kingmaker. I want to know what that is, what that means. You grew up in New England, in Massachusetts, I think.
I did.
In Mass.
Yeah.
You were a state champion hockey player. I'm going to make a dad joke. You played left wing, which is kind of funny.
I know. I feel bad. Feel bad for your interns having to unearth that research right there. But yeah, 92 Mass State hockey champion.
Don't
go Harborman.
That's pretty awesome. I love that. Let's. I want to start. So, give the people what they want, kind of. So I was kind of, I think you were doing this a little bit at breakfast. I was sort of informally crowdsourcing in an analog way yesterday. What do people want? And I think basically the common denominator was kind of like an anguished sigh combined with like a horrible groan. And if I can distill that down, it was kind of like, what's going on? We're business people and we're centrist and doesn't everybody kind of agree with us and why can't we get this right? Maybe Phil, start. Like, can you try and unpack that a little bit? And like, what are people reacting to and what are you seeing in with your clients and the numbers?
Well, I mean, I think in general, you know, that's representative sort of where America is right now. And John can speak to this probably better than I, but there's great dissatisfaction with both choices this year, right? That's the bottom line. And, you know, we always talk about the third party candidates. Many of you may remember 92 when Ross Perot got, I think, 19% of the vote that year. You have a bucket of third party candidates probably led by RFK Jr., who I think, you know, having sat through a lot of focus groups and seen a lot of polling, read a lot of crosstabs, I actually think the third party vote will be impactful this year. And for no other reason than I think there's going to be a significant protest vote in the presidential. Presidential race is not about 50 states, as we all know. It's really about, you know, six or seven. And in those, you know, six or seven states, it's, you know, if you have an RFK end up getting 5 to 7%, it's something to keep a close eye on for guys like us that actually are responsible, you know, for strategy and spending the money in these campaigns. So it's real. I mean, Biden's numbers are not great. His job approval, you know, low 40s, in some states, high 30s. Trump is leading in probably six to seven of those battleground states, with the exception of Pennsylvania. But his numbers, you know, his ballot share is kind of capped right around 40. Low 40s. So, you know, anything can happen. And I think it's just a, you know, there's a sentiment, particularly in the Republican Party, that Washington is broken, that, you know, the country is on the wrong track, and that folks, that they really don't have a voice, right, in the halls of power. Yep. And we've seen that play out numerous times over the last, you know, 4, 8, 12 years, and it's getting worse. And so I think, you know, it's a little bit of a depressing time, I think, for average voters. But there are real important things that are going to be determined in this next election in these next 4 years. So,
I mean, John, what are you seeing from the numbers, maybe from the primaries, for example?
First, welcome to your, you know, political therapy session, right? Because everyone, I had breakfast with some people. Everyone, you know, was peppering with great questions and anxiety, right? Because there's certain anxiety out there. Yeah. And, you know, as a pollster, you know, we believe in polling. Polling's important. Polling in time, meaning right now, is probably noise. We're in the strangest environment because we're in this post-COVID, kind of post-inflationary, there's still like this low-grade fever in America. When reporters call me and ask me questions about polling, I said, I'll give you my, you know, thoughts on where the polls are, what they mean, but you really should call a psychologist. And I don't mean that as like joking. I mean, we're in a very strange time in America. We have this political divide that is real and it's intense. We have this character, Donald Trump, who has changed the dynamics of everything in our lives. Put Joe Biden on hold for a second. To the point where, you know, for example, there's certain diagnostics, the job rating for the economy. You guys are all smart people. You see the numbers on the economy. We have a pretty good economy. And yet, if you take a look at the polls, 63% of the people say the economy is moving in the wrong direction. Well, again, all these diagnostics have become political. Everything in our lives have been political, so we're all uncomfortable. If you have a Democratic president, Republicans say the economy is shitty. If you have a Republican president, the Democrats say the economy is shitty. But when you take a look, for example, at the Wall Street Journal poll, if you take a look at individual states, how's the economy in North Carolina, Michigan, et cetera, everything's over 50% positive. So you have to start looking at different diagnostics as well, just like when you go in to buy a company, right? You're not going to just look at the first set of books. You're going to start asking questions really deep. For example, when you ask, what is your personal satisfaction? America's personal satisfaction is in the 70s, like 78%. Much different than what you see in the other diagnostics.
How does that compare historically?
Historically, it is almost as high. What's different, and I think worth noting, is the very satisfied is down. It's historically low in the last two decades, but still a little bit under 50%. Don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to put rose-colored glasses on here. This is going to be a tight race. I think we all have to remind ourselves, 2016, Trump won by 77,000 votes in three states. 2020, Biden won by 44,000 votes in three states. And oh, by the way, two of the states were different than 2016. Yeah. So everyone knows it's going to be a close race. And what I had suggested to you guys at the table is for high information people who, you know, need this therapy session, put this election right now, compartmentalize it, put it in a box, put it way up on, you know, in your closet shelf, and take that box out on Labor Day, and you'll save yourself a lot of anger.
Okay, you said a lot of things I want to follow up on.
Yeah.
There's no way this room's going to do that, so we got to talk about that. But I want to double click on the economy for a second. So satisfaction, if you look at, I get that point, states, yeah, people, blah, 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 but sort of nationally they feel bad. And let's defend a position on any particular thing. I'm interested in what the numbers say and what you're seeing in the numbers, and Phil, what you're also seeing just with your clients and when you're out there. Is it people just don't get it? People are wearing a uniform so they know they have to say what their team is saying? Or I think Larry Summers did something like 10 days ago where he released, hey, listen, if you, I'm not gonna get this right, but if you look at the way we used to measure inflation before we changed it, and you put in what people used to think about as, you know, what they're paying for things, they're paying more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like what are you seeing
yes,
in the numbers?
Yes, no doubt about it. I think you can't put your head in the sand that the cost of living is still one of the top drivers of people's, you know, personal satisfaction and or financial. And things are just higher, you know, regardless of whether inflation is steadied, right?
Right.
So it's not about the inflation rate or whether it's steady, it's about the cost of living. And I think that, again, if you're in a campaign, we get that, right? And the president gets that, and he talks about, hey, things are still way too high.
Yeah.
But here's what I'm doing about it, right? Uh-huh. And, you know, Trump doesn't have a plan, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's no doubt that you have to meet people where they are.
Uh-huh.
And that is where they are.
Yeah.
But they're also on a bunch of different issues, and we can talk about that
later.
We should.
I mean, I had two governors in my house Saturday night, last Saturday, and they're Western Utah, Montana. Utah, Montana. And the number one thing they talked about was the cost of housing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's just very interesting. And I don't think you can, you know, you can read the Wall Street Journal every day and hear about the statistics and all that, but the fact of the matter is, if you compare where people are today, where they were 4 or 5 years ago, it's harder. It's harder for an average family. It's gas, it's groceries, it's housing, it's the cost of college. I mean, all of these things, right, combine to contribute to that sentiment that 2/3 of Americans believe the country's on the wrong track and the economy's on the wrong track.
And I think what you say is interesting, because this race, there's going to be almost, ready for this number, $3 billion spent just on paid communication in the presidential campaigns. 76% of that is going to be...
I think that number's low.
Is going to be, well, 76% of that is going to be spent in seven states that Phil was talking about. Nevada, for example, housing's a real problem. California investors have come in there, gobbled up housing and apartments, everything is right. So that is a big issue. And my point being is that the issues in Nevada are going to be, for example, different than the issues in North Carolina.
Yep.
And you will see very specific campaigns, I think, in each of those states.
John, maybe just to pull back to generalities, or what do you actually do? Like with the number?
Yeah.
Like.
No, it's a great question.
Yeah. I mean, because I think one of the things I've heard you say is, I'm glad I'm not in D.C. It's helpful to me.
Yeah.
And I was interested by that because numbers are numbers and you're looking at numbers, but
right,
there's a feel thing too.
I try not to be influenced by anything that comes out of D.C. because it's usually wrong, number one. And there is a you know, there's an echo chamber, right? I mean, there's a real echo chamber.
Groupthink.
There's a herding. And I've lived in, Montgomery, Alabama, raised my kids there. My ex-wife was from there. That kind of explains why. But the fact is I've never watched cable TV. I've never watched Rachel Maddow. I've never watched Morning Joe. And the fact is that I just don't want to be influenced by what, you know, the talking heads are doing. What I do is I talk to real people. I talk to unfiltered, as a pollster, I'm talking to real people, whether it's for a campaign, for electoral politics, or a campaign for corporations, which I do a lot of. And I want you to think of polling and getting the attitudes of voters or customers as an efficiency tool. I mean, that's what I'm doing. You guys go in and buy a company, again, you look at the books, but you're doing a heck of a lot more than looking at the books, right? I don't care what you think about, you know, Elon Musk, but Walter Isaacson's book on him is fantastic. And one of the things you find out is that Elon Musk slept for weeks and weeks and months on the floor of his factory when they started it. Well, in some ways, that's what a pollster is doing. They're literally going into the homes and getting the attitudes of voters unfiltered from what anyone else can do. And we're seeing things differently than what opinion leaders see. And it's an efficiency tool to find not only what the right messages are, but it's also who are receptive to those messages. And when you're spending, you know, millions or billions of dollars, you're going to want that type of guidance when you do your advertising campaigns.
I mean, I think I've heard you say, like, the best way to know a state is to caucus there. What does that mean?
Well, for example, when you're in political business, you're at one point a bottom feeder. Like, that is the best thing that can happen to you. Like, and when I started my firm, I was driving around Southwest Virginia getting legislative races in the panhandle of Florida and getting legislative races. And, you know, we would do these caucuses, which mean the state legislatures, North Carolina, New Jersey, Florida, Illinois. And so you just learn a state literally legislative district by legislative district, right? And that gives you just this really valuable information when you look at things at a state level or in a presidential campaign at a presidential level.
Is there an example either from 2022 or like now as you're receiving wisdom, you're hearing this is what's going on in a particular state, in a particular region of a state, and you're like, that doesn't make any sense to me based on what I know about Macomb County, Michigan, or whatever?
I'll look at it a little differently. My experience in Hillary Clinton's campaign, which actually was a good experience, a great relationship with her, and I think incredibly highly of her, and the staff was really professional. But the difference between 2020 was that Biden was going to places like Beaver County. He was going to places like Erie, Pennsylvania. And in 2016, we tended to go to the Phillies and the Pittsburghs, right? And so getting into the hinterlands, right, the Scrantons of the world, I do Gretchen Whitmer. Like, she spends a lot of time, if you're from up in the Upper Peninsula in northern Michigan, Traverse City, you know, those hard markets. Rick Scott, who I've run against three times, lost against three times, all by 1%. This is a guy who goes after our base and goes to Democratic places. And so, you know, you have to talk to everyone.
Yeah. Let's talk about eating into the base. And Phil, you mentioned the protest vote. Let's talk about, the New York Times ran a big piece, I don't know, 2 weekends ago, like breaking down the primary and caucus data, which I'd love to hear how you guys think, how reliable that is, just given it was kind of truncated and it was kind of distorted for a lot of reasons. But their point was, there's a big protest vote in the Democratic primaries against Biden. One of those categories was Hispanic voters. And what's your take on that? Is that real? We're in Arizona. It's kind of very relevant here, for example.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've done a lot of work in and around this community. It's a very diverse community.
Not a monolith.
It's different from state to state. It's different within states. Florida, Governor DeSantis won Hispanics in 22. Rick Scott, as you said, really targeted Hispanics, showed up. I think they're actually the key swing vote in the electorate right now. Because if you just look at their performance over the last three or four election cycles, you know, they're not embedded with one party. They're just not. And so if you look at Florida Republicans, Governor DeSantis won Miami-Dade County for the first time really in history. You know, they care about what every American cares about. They care about, you know, the economy first and foremost, public safety, education,
Does government serve them in a way? I think you really got to keep an eye on how the candidates are, and you have to show up, to John's point, right? I think the candidates that I advise, it's like you got to go places where maybe you're not naturally comfortable at the beginning, and you got to show up and put in the work because it's a respect thing, particularly in that community. One of the things we talk about, you know, at this level is you have to advertise in language. You see a lot of candidates that'll, you know, slap subtitles on English. It doesn't work, right? Like, you have to go ahead and create media in language and target it to the right folks. And then understanding that, particularly in a place like Florida or Texas, the communities are very, very different. Miami is very different than Orlando. And the same thing, you can say that about Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, all these states, right? And you have to understand, from our perspective, how that looks. And I think, look, Trump did quite well among Hispanics. We have Republican governors around the country, DeSantis, Abbott, others, who've really figured out, unlock the key and really show up and put in the time. So it's going to be really interesting. John was talking about Rick Scott. I think our team has really learned the lessons. I think we still lag Democrats in a lot of areas, but we're showing up. We're putting in the time. We're devoting the resources to that community, and I think it's going to pay dividends.
And just to dissect the Latino community a little bit more, because I mean, it is the community, and I think every demographic, when you have a race that's won by 44,000, 77,000 is important. Like, you can't leave anyone off the table. But I do think that the evolution of the Latino vote is really an important kind of case study. One is the Latino as an umbrella doesn't work. You are Venezuelan American,
right?
Colombian American, Mexican American, Puerto Rican. And you communicate that way, not only in the language, but talking about that. If you're in Florida, you are buying Haitian radio, Haitian American radio, yep. Right? And it's just so divergent. But I don't think that there's enough conversation about the evolution of the Hispanic vote. My parents were first generation Sicilian American, right? Like, my grandparents had broken English. All they wanted to be was American. They didn't want to learn the language, et cetera. And I think we forget that there's a lot of that in the Latino community, that after the first generation, you know, you're Colombian American, you just want to be American, right? And you start assimilating, and again, so all of a sudden, party ideology is not really important. And so they're a persuadable universe. You have to go out and fight for them. The other thing that I think is really important that you start looking at with the Latino community is that they're mostly Catholic, but it's the biggest, the fastest growing universe in the evangelical and Pentecostal, yep. Is Latinos moving over from Catholicism to evangelical Pentecostal. Once they're in those churches, welcomed by those, they're Republicans. Right? And so there's a lot going on. This isn't just, oh, Trump or this, whatever. There is an evolution of, you know, again, Latino Americans assimilating into kind of more of being American, more than just being Latino. And I think we forget that in a lot of ways.
And the hit on the Hispanic Latino community has been, there's a lot of them, but they don't show up. And I think if you look particularly at the midterms in 22 and 20 and in 16, they're starting to show up. They're showing up now.
Yeah.
At a level that's equivalent to African-American voters.
Yeah.
So
I think the thing to look for when you're looking at polling right now is, you know, there's just myth, quite frankly. There's just wrong narrative by the media that Biden is bleeding the base. Now, and what they do is there's like, you know, Biden got 91% of African-Americans in 2020, you know, based on exit polls, or Biden got 63% of or 68 of Latinos, and they compare it to where he's in polling. If you know anything about polling, the fact is that African-Americans, young people, Latinos, always poll lower than where they are. And then after Labor Day, that number starts solidifying. And you'll never hit the 91% that you're gonna get in a poll.
But the other thing, just to recognize, for those of you who are picking up the Wall Street Journal every day and reading, most of the public polling out there is garbage, okay?
Explain that.
You look at the mainstream media polls, and the methodology is flawed.
Yeah.
They are doing national polls, which are largely meaningless, in my view, for what we do. And it's just, but it's, why do they do the polling? they do the poll so they get, they have something to talk about in terms of content on the Sunday shows, you know, and all their various media platforms.
And great clicks. I mean, they get, yeah, a lot of clicks.
That's it.
I mean, I really, as a pollster, I do one thing, and I would recommend this to you. Go to 538.com, which is Nate Cohn now, and Nate Silver used to have it, and at RCP, Real Clear Politics. And they are an aggregator. They take and aggregate all the polls and try to take the noise out of them and give you averages. And I think that's the way to look at polling nowadays, because there's just so many bad polls. Like when we go, when I think about when I started out in politics, you had five or six polls. And yep. Now polling has become like political porn. I mean, that's what it is. Yep. And it's really important for media firms. But guess what? Do you think media firms spend a lot of money on polling? No, they don't. That's why when Tony Fabrizio, who's Trump's pollster, and I were approached to start the Wall Street Journal poll, they were committed to spending real money to do it the right way. Large sample sizes, multimodal, which meant, you know, you were getting people a bunch of different ways. And I think that they do a really good job. But there's just a lot of bad polling out there where, for example, they're online using panels, which we call opt-in, where sometimes 40% of those panels are almost professional pulse takers, right, and things like that. So that's where we get the bad reputation sometimes, yeah. Is internally what we're doing for campaigns and corporations, we spend a lot of time and a lot of money doing it the right way, and the media polls don't and often miss it.
Your career straddle, so that's one reason why polls have gotten a bad rap, that I get. Your career also straddles like going digital.
Yes.
Trump, realignment of things. Like, yeah. What have you learned? What have you changed to get it better?
So I think if we're being honest with ourselves, Trump really changed how polling's done. Meaning like he's different, and his people are different, and they're hard to get. And so, you know, we've had to move. For example, there's just certain people who will not take a live interview. But they will online, you know. So, for example, you know, some people still have landlines, so we do a little bit of landline. We do about 78 or 80% of our interviews cut between live cell and what we call text to web. You may get a text, and then you take it online. And we find that people who take things online look very different. We get the hard-to-reach voters by going online,
yeah.
Right? Including our own party, right, who might not want to, you know, give answers to live interviewers. So it's like any company. I don't care whether you're a steel manufacturer or you're a software company. If you are not evolving, you know, you're going to die. And so we're constantly evolving, as well as not only in terms of how we're getting interviews, but how we're making sure we're getting the right interviews or the correct interviews. 2016, we were getting our non-college educated voter universe, but we weren't getting the right type of college educated voter. Stay with me for a second. Think about the transition over decades. My dad was a long haul trucker, right? He was a blue collar guy and he was a Teamster. And that's kind of what you had. But now you have non-college educated, where people who work with their hands or drive or agriculture or whatever, works in manufacturing. And then you have a whole universe of non-college educated voter who are in the service industry. And guess what? A lot of them live in the suburbs, and you're an administrator for a dental firm, and you don't have a college education, but you're acting much like a suburban voter. And so we have to get those type of mixes right, which is not something that we had to do in the past.
Right.
You have to get the right interviews. Super expensive and takes a long time.
And Phil, you're the, you know, tippy top of the most sophisticated consumers of these things. Like, what are you, and maybe your clients are like, do we need to spend, like, what are you looking for, and how are you sourcing the right kind of data when you're talking to your clients,
well,
political clients?
I mean, we use the right pollsters. We're not, we have to, the challenge with us is like, you know, there's so many polls out there now, yeah. So that whether it's corporate client or political client, you know, poll comes out and, you know, political client, you know, all the internals show that they're up, you know, 5 to 7 points. Poll comes out, they're down two. And it's like, we have to take half our day to explain why that's not true.
Panic.
Right, yeah, panic. So what I would say is, from my perspective, you know, we try to look at a lot of different sources of data. And I think there's too many people in our business who are senior strategists, general consultants, who simply read the poll and write the TV ad based on the language in the poll.
Right.
Okay, there's no thought or creativity that goes into it really beyond that, okay? And there is something to be said for, you know, getting out in the community, talking to a lot of different people, using your instincts, knowing that, okay, yeah, that may work, that may pull, that may on the paper show that, you know, 70% of the electorate's gonna be moved by that. But that's not the issue we want to be talking about. Right? There's an issue matrix right now, and I think one of the reasons why Trump has a really good chance of winning this year is because the issues that Trump is most aggressive on, is most consistent on, are the issues that also the American people think are the most important. So right now, you know, Trump's been talking about the border before really a lot of people were talking about it. It's now become one of the top three issues in the campaign. China, huge issue. I think it's going to define not only the next 4 years, but the next 50. The economy, obviously that's one where both parties are going to have to battle really hard. I think they both have core messages that they're going to advance. So it's really trying to be thoughtful about you know, everything that's going on in the universe and the political environment around you, and not just, you know, taking the number from one pollster. We use multiple pollsters. No offense, John. We're not going to put all of our eggs in one basket. And you know, when you have a divergence of numbers, you have to ask why. You have to look under the hood the same way you would do when you're assessing investment in a company. Why is it? What did you do? What were the assumptions that you made when you actually were looking, you know, to construct this poll? So we do a lot of qualitative data. We do quantitative data. We go in and we listen. I learn more from focus groups than I actually do, you know, sitting in a room for two, three hours or watching them online, you know, watching, you know, the night manager from Walmart, you know, react to a message and how he thinks about it, how he processes it, how he talks about it. It's just what we do every day, right? But having to put all those data points together to come up with sort of the right way you're not going to necessarily, a candidate hopefully knows what they stand for, knows what they want to talk about in the context of a campaign. Your job is to really help them sharpen that message, right? And then think about the delivery mechanisms to generate, you know, the most enthusiasm. And you're not going to change who they are, but listening to those conversations, I've never walked out of a focus group and not learn something, not got a little bit smarter.
I think that's right. I mean, we do a lot of focus groups, whether they're in person or online. And I would say that, you know, we're known for our political campaigns, but we do a lot of corporate work. And I would say that the qualitative is probably the most helpful in corporate work. You know, every major corporation should be doing research, but do it in a campaign style way, not a marketing way. There's completely different.
Explain.
We go into major Fortune 100 companies, and they just do marketing. They do marketing research, very simplistic stuff. They're not good on kind of message testing of where they should go in their advertising. I'll give you a great example. A company recently where they have a theory of the case. You go do focus groups, you do some polling, and they were way off. Right, and again, we're an efficiency tool, right, to help them spend their communication dollars the right way. Another recent one for a company in a battleground state, but a Republican, more Republican state governor, you know, where there's this myth that, you know, new energy, green energy is a woke issue for Republicans. It isn't. No, matter of fact, Republicans at a very high level think that we should be producing more solar and wind. They just believe that it should be all of the above, right? And so they're missing out on a communications opportunity in their state talking about the investment in the electrical grid or the investment in new energy because they're worried about Republican leaders. Well, there's a huge disconnect often between Democrat and Republican leaders or legislators and what real people think, right? And so again, you know, you're Where you go wrong, mostly, and my corporate clients go wrong, is they do the data and they put it up on a shelf because everyone's scared to make a decision. And that's the biggest problem that corporate clients have.
We just passed the quarter end, lots of stories about fundraising. Biden was way ahead, Trump raised $56 million, but RNC's got new rules, he can use it for legal fees, whatever. Like, how's that gonna flow through?
It's not how much you raise, it's how much you spend and how you spend it.
Okay.
And if it's going to legal fees, it's not going to field, it's not going to TV, digital, mail, radio, scheduling, you know, staff, et cetera. That is a huge problem.
And that impacts the presidential, the down ballot? What are you thinking?
Look, I think it's certainly everything with Trump is unique and unprecedented, right? So we're in an unprecedented phase here. But, you know, the bottom line is he wrapped the primary up historically early. The folks that fund campaigns, you know, they tend to be a lot of billionaires, you know, write the big checks, soft money checks, 10 million up. They're coming around on our side. It's a progression, right? There were folks who supported DeSantis, supported Nikki. But at the end of the day, you know, they think they're going to be better off under a Trump presidency than another 4 years of Biden. So those folks are going to write checks. I mean, I'm on the board of the Senate Leadership Fund. You know, they're going to spend, you know, $250, $300 million or more this cycle. You know, the analog, the Senate Majority PAC, on the other side is going to spend that much as well. There's plenty of money in politics, period. You know, it comes down to how you target it, how you spend it, and what the message is. And voters are smart. I mean, they take all these different data points. It's not just about the number of TV ads you see, okay? It's not just about the quality of the TV ads, right? It's what is, like we were talking about this last night, you know, I think for Biden, the number one thing for him is, like, if they debate, can he show up and perform in that debate? Uh-huh. There's more than anything else, that's what's going to impact those very small group of voters who are still persuadable. In this country, there's not a lot of them left.
Right.
Okay. People have got their team jerseys on. They made up their minds.
Voters also, they are smart, and they do take in a lot of data points. But one big one is a risk quotient. And I saw this firsthand in 2016. Donald Trump was the risk until Comey came in and opened up the FBI investigation. And they're like, oh, she's in a risk and she'll be under investigation and impeachment, all this stuff. We might as well look at the new guy. And so the risk quotient is very high for him on several different ways. One, he has a bunch of trials. And if he gets convicted, we know there's probably about 25% of the electorate, including his voters, who say that they probably won't vote for him because of that, right? But his other risk quotient is just like, what is he going to say tomorrow?
You're missing the obvious risk quotient.
Hold on, Joe Biden.
Is he going to survive a second term?
I'm talking about the risk quotient of this election and getting here, which again is the fact that people now can say, oh yeah, you know, he's a businessman, he understands the economy, but at the end of the day, the risk quotient is, can I live 4 more years with this guy as president with what he put me through with his behavior previously?
And
that is his problem.
Is, can I live 4 more years?
And let me tell you what, and people won't start focusing on that until post-Labor Day.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's where the rubber hits the road and the PTSD will hit in, it will really kick in on Trump. So again, you can say all you want about on the Biden stuff is, but the reality is the risk factors are much higher with Trump because he's his own worst enemy.
Yeah, let's talk about Dobbs. So and abortion, reproductive rights. And I don't mean to make this glib, but does this still have legs?
Like, okay.
Is that,
so yeah. Last week, I live in Alabama, one of the reddest states there is.
You just had a state legislative.
We just had a state legislative special election, a Republican legislative seat right around Huntsville. I think it was an all-white seat, basically, suburbs, where a woman won the seat with 64% of the vote, running TV ads on abortion rights and IVR. Do you think it has legs?
Seems like it. Yeah,
that's what Kansas, you know, beat back a referendum in the off year. You know, Gretchen Whitmer, just look at one, my client Gretchen Whitmer, strong on her own, but there was an abortion referendum on the ballot because there was something in the Constitution. And again, we didn't even see, quite frankly, the full effect of how strong it was until Election Day. So it is something that is real and has an impact.
Yeah. Is that going to make a difference in Florida? They're trying to get it on the ballot in Florida to try and...
It'll be on the ballot.
Yeah.
It's not going to make a difference in Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Florida is an interesting case.
Well, it could pass in Florida.
Sure. But the, you know, Florida has become so much more Republican. And it's actually been kind of an ideological migration. If you think about it, you have folks who move from Michigan, New York, California, wherever, particularly during the pandemic, because... and they're Republicans, like for the most part, right? And so, you know, when we started in spring of 21 with DeSantis, there were 300,000 more registered Democrats in the state than Republicans today. There's, I don't know, 500,000 or more registered Republicans. So you look at that. Florida, you know, 2000, the hanging chads was obviously the swingiest of swing states. It's just not that anymore.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of different stories in Florida, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but for example, minimum wage passed the referendum with over 60%, medical marijuana. I think both the pro reproductive rights and the full marijuana will do it. So there's a lot of, these aren't super conservatives like Alabama. It is a fairly progressive state on the social issues. It is just an expensive state.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to, as a U.S. Senate candidate, somehow think about how you're going to get $200 million to compete.
Right.
That's the problem with Florida.
Got it. Angry vote versus affirmative vote. That breaks different ways. John, I've heard you talk about it in other contexts, that Republicans are more likely to be sort of pro-Trump as opposed to anti-Biden. Democrats are definitely voting against Trump. And that plays in the Democrats' hands?
Well, I think that I would look at it a different way, which is people always want to talk about enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Gallup came out with a great poll today, which kind of broke the myth that there's this greater enthusiasm with Republicans. There is greater enthusiasm maybe for Trump. But the fact is that the enthusiasm level's within like 4 points, right, of the election, which is much different than it was in the previous election,
yeah.
Right? Enthusiasm way low for Democrats in 16. It was higher in 2020. But the fact is that it's kind of what Joe Biden always says. At the end of the day, this is going to be about a choice, right? And that's why I say just wait until post-Labor Day to really, you know, angst on this election, because people are going to come into a choice, and they're also going to have to make a binary choice, most likely.
Okay, so you said Labor Day, put it on a shelf. I said this room doesn't do that. And so let me color that up a little bit. And if I think the FT ran a story last week, maybe last Friday, the VIX, it's not really an index, right, Marty? It's more like a composite. It's a proxy. Okay, which measures volatility. It's up like higher than historical levels, like in an election year this early. And the story was talking about how people were bringing their companies are bringing their capital raises, like they're bringing them up earlier, like they don't want to be in the market in the fourth quarter, they want to have like their cash ready to go. So are we overreacting? Like, because we're predicting, we don't know what the hell is going to happen.
Volatility, yeah. Volatility in the market or volatility in the...
No, in our sentiment, like, you know... Yeah.
But who are you really worried about?
Let me ask it this way. You're going into companies and they're like, what do you think is going to happen? What should we do? Who should we get close to? What should we be worried about? What regulation is coming? Gee, big tech regulation is... Everybody hates big tech. Is that going to still continue, or is this going to be a free-for-all once Trump gets elected, if that happens? Like, what are you... How are you breaking that down for people? Maybe that's a way to ask it.
Yeah, look, I look at what he's talking about. Okay, he's talked about the border, he's talking about the economy, he's talking about China, he talks about public safety, he talks about, you know, largely trying to avoid foreign entanglements, a little bit more America first, right?
Yeah.
That is sort of the arc of America first, MAGA, however you wanted to define it, okay? It's still Washington, okay? So we're going to have, most likely going to have, divided government, okay? Republicans very likely to win the Senate, House, you know, what are we, 4-seat margin in the House now?
I mean, it's going to be one.
Yeah, House is probably more likely to go Democrat, and then the presidential is a toss-up at this point. But either way, it's going to be divided government. So there's really three parties in Washington. There's the Democrats, there's the Republicans, and then there's appropriators, okay? And I think last year, I think 27 bills passed. 27, that's it, right? So
what's going to get done? Well, we're going to fund government, despite all the, you know, posturing that will happen and always does happen. Government's going to get funded. Defense appropriations. The big stuff will get done. There's going to be something that happens on the border. I don't think it's going to happen before November, for all the political reasons that we're all aware of. But, you know, and then there's going to be, you know, a lot of talk if Trump gets in about defense, about China, NATO, about Ukraine. So I think from a business standpoint, you can predict actually more of the same, right? Regardless of who's going to be in there, because you have divided government in Washington, D.C. If you're trying to proactively get something done, mm-hmm. you want to try to fold it into that rubric, okay? So if you're producing something domestically, talk about it as it relates to China. Okay, we don't have to get this product from China now. Now we can get it from the U.S., okay? Talk about it in those terms. That's how you're going to be successful in a Trump administration. It's always trying to meet, and candidly, it applies to all politicians wherever they are. You try to meet the politicians where they are. You try to present yourself as a partner to them and trying to help them, you know, accomplish what they want to accomplish, you know, both politically and in their priorities. There's this great machinery of government that exists underneath, you know, the cabinet secretaries, right? And the Democrats are a lot better. You can call it the deep state, call it the administrative state, call it whatever you want. But that's where a lot of the real work happens, right? And, you know, if you're outside of Washington, D.C., you know, I would recommend hiring GP3 coming in.
right. Let's do an architecture.
We'll help you yeah. get it done. But it's, I think in terms of volatility matrix that you talked about at the top, I actually think it's going to be fairly more of the same. You know, the stuff that's clickbait, that sells newspapers, that gets eyeballs online, you know, it tends to be the stuff that's more volatile, that's more sexy, but that's not what is happening most of the time in Washington and in states.
I mean, I agree with Phil that, you know, we're probably continue to be divided government. And like, for example, tech reform. I mean, it's gone nowhere. I mean, under how many presidents? But when you did see Biden and then the president had both the House and the Senate as Democrats, I mean, things get done. I mean, Republicans, you know, I think when they're in control, they stop stuff. Right? Maybe you can say they're stopping bad stuff or they're stopping good stuff, whatever. But the fact is that, you know, when Biden had both houses of the Senate, he did more to invest in the economic infrastructure of this country than just about anyone in modern presidency, whether it's the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the CHIPS and Science Act that brought innovative manufacturing back here and the supply chain, and the money in IRA for things like new energy, et cetera. And so, I mean, there's one guy who has a history of investing in America's future, right? And it's real. I don't think that that's... I don't think that that's, you know, I don't think that that's spin. I mean, the fact is that all that's real stuff, and most of that was bipartisan. But, you know, the fact is that if you have divided government, the best that you can hope for is that you're going to get a supplemental bill passed and, you know, the Speaker of the House is going to get in trouble for doing it.
I have a million more questions, but we're going to open it up to Q&A and see if other people have similar questions or different questions.
I've got a million questions too, but I'll ask some easy ones. Just electoral college versus popular vote from your standpoint of what you do.
You know, listen, the Democrats and the campaigns said this. You can have the blue wall, which is, you know, basically Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And then you have the Southeast and Southwest, which is Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia. And then you have North Carolina, which is kind of like, you know, another one. And then you have these two congressional districts, one in Maine and one in Nebraska, because they don't do, you know... Winner take all, right? And so there's a bunch of different variations on it. And so the national vote matters in one, it's a great narrative. It's also an indicator a lot of times what the margin is of what's going to happen on the electoral side in the states. But this is all state by state. I mean, that's what we're going to look at.
And we didn't even get to state races and governor races.
These Senate races, you have to look at these states in these congressional districts that are like pile-on states, right? So Pennsylvania, competitive, highly competitive swing state on the presidential, also highly competitive Senate race. Wisconsin, highly competitive Senate race, right on down the line, right? Yeah. So it's like
the presidentials, what you're saying, match up with the battleground Senate states almost perfectly.
100%.
So just to call that, I think what you're talking about is the dynamic where there's a statewide race that can change or drive turnout in the presidential because people are very interested in what's going on in that race in that
right.
state.
Literally, the only places where there's not a competitive, and I mean toss-up race for Senate that's also a presidential, is Georgia and North Carolina. Yeah. They don't have it.
Right? It's also like the party infrastructure on the ground game, folks turning out, knocking on doors, turning folks out. That really matters. If you have a good governor's race or a good Senate race down ticket, that will help to drive a lot of that for the presidential.
Yep, got it.
So where does healthcare poll? You know, it's soon going to be crushing our economy, soon be 20% of GDP. Medicare Advantage is really becoming a problem for the government, paying too much money for the service it's getting. Do the Americans care about health care in the dialogue, and how does that relate to the presidential election, and how does that poll out?
Yeah, I think a couple different ways. One is it's still one of the top issues, but it just gets blocked out a bit because of the other issues that are going on, whether it's the wars or whether it's immigration or the cost of living, et cetera, et cetera. I think you're going to see it manifest in this election a couple different ways. Trump has been very clear that he wants to repeal ACA, which now has almost a 6% favorable. 20-something million people use it. It's important to keep costs down. It's actually a successful program. The second is that seniors are a key group in this election, like they always are, because they vote disproportionately high. And the fact is that when you have things like $35 insulin, $2,000 cap on your prescription drugs, negotiating with Medicare, those healthcare issues are super important to voters over, really over 55, et cetera. And I think that, we tend to forget, but I think, I don't want to speak for women, but women view reproductive rights as a healthcare issue. And I think that that is really important as well.
But it is not a top three issue election. It's not.
But so you'll see plenty of ads on them.
Sure.
All right, last question. So what, you guys mentioned 538, or you mentioned John 538. Uh-huh. What else are you looking at? What should we be reading, looking at? Who's reliable? What can we do to help kind of separate signal from noise?
Well, when I wake up in the morning, I mean, everyone's different. I don't watch cable news. I love Mike Allen's morning newsletter. I think it's very efficient. It's quick. It's a quick read. And he is about trends. Him and his partner, Jim Vander, whatever, are about trends. And they make you think about things that you don't normally think about. If you're a political animal, you got to kind of do the political playbook, which I think is long, but it gives you all the basic politics. And I just love the AP morning newsletter because it's not politics. It's just news. It helps you kind of like, realize that there's other things going on in the world.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at how people are feeling about their own personal economy, right? That's the thing that I'm sort of looking at right now. We talked about this an hour ago, but it was, folks they feel like they're struggling, whether or not the economic indicators are good or bad, right? That's Wall Street. That's up here. That's in the sky. They feel like they're paying more for gas, groceries, housing, the whole thing. So I keep, if that somehow changes in the next 6 months where people are starting to feel better about the economy, then I think that certainly helps.
And economic sentiment.
But if it doesn't, then I think, famously said, it's the economy, stupid.
And if you look at the economic,
your own personal economy,
right?
But it's not the macro economy.
And the economic sentiment numbers are going up, again, whether it gets to the point where people shift their feeling on it. But if you look at the University of
Michigan,
there
was only one way to go, John, which was up.
No, there isn't, because it's actually fairly volatile.
From where we were.
It's actually fairly volatile. It's hard to kind of figure out why people change their sentiment within a given year.
Okay. Therapy session? failed information, like super helpful. You guys are great. Thank you for taking the time, and we really appreciate it. So
thank
thanks.
You for your time.
Happy to do it.
Yeah.
That was John Anzalone and Phil Cox. We spoke on April 4th, 2024 at Sixth Street Growth's annual CXO Summit in Scottsdale, Arizona. You heard about the value of knowing local dynamics and engaging directly with voters. You heard about the unpredictability of political races and how factors like third-party candidates and ideological migration and voter turnout will significantly impact outcomes in this election cycle. You heard about the volatility in the market and the importance of understanding and navigating political dynamics for businesses. And finally, you heard about the importance of understanding public sentiment behind the screen of media narratives and partisan agendas. Huge thank you to John and Phil. This was a very engaging discussion. Access to unbiased data is essential to the success of our democracy, and our team at Sixth Street appreciates you both taking the time to help us separate the signal from the noise. Thanks to everyone for listening. You can read more about our guests on sixthstreet.com and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please share it and follow us at Sixth Street News on X for more news on the show and our firm. Thanks to Sixth Street's production team, Patrick Clifford, Rip Vishaw, and Rebecca Vignali for putting this together with video producer Taylor Jenkins. Our theme song is It's Not Magic, an original creation by Patrick Dyer Wolf. Once again, I'm David Stiepelman. Thanks for listening. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Sixth Street, and Sixth Street is not providing any investing, financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice or recommendations in this podcast. Please see additional disclosures on our website for more details.